5 teenagers came out of a burger joint with a bag of hamburgers. They were laughing, but suddenly stopped dead.
"Jimmy?"
a pretty girl said.
"What are you doing? Ain't it a little cool for that?"
a boy said.
"Jim?"
They began to approach it. It stayed calm, knowing it could easily kill all of them. But there was no need. They kept making noises.
"Something's wrong," an older one said. "Did you have an accident, Jim?"
"He drove out with his surfing board after lunch,"
the pretty girl said, and looked down the road.
"I don't see his car."
It didn't remember what language was, but it knew how whales communicated. It tried to repeat the sound they had been making.
"Jim?"
"Oh my God," the girl said. "Maybe he hit his head."
She approached it and reached toward its face. It swatted her arms away.
"Ow! My God, Jim!"
She felt her forearm where it had almost fractured it.
"My God,"
it said, trying to duplicate her facial expression. One of the boys pulled the girl back.
"Something crazy's going on. Watch out for him."
"Officer,"
the older girl shouted.
"Officer Sherman."
A big man in a blue uniform hustled across the street.
"Jim Barry?
What the hell?"
"He hit me,"
the pretty one said.
"He's acting crazy."
"My God, Jim,"
it said, duplicating her intonation.
"Wear your clothes, buddy,"
Sherman said, unbuttoning his holster. It realized that it was in a complex and dangerous situation. It knew these were social creatures, and they were obviously communicating. Best try to learn how.
"Wear your clothes, buddy," it said in a deep bass growl.
"He might have hit his head surfing,"
the girl who was cradling her arm said.
"You know he's not a mean guy."
"I don't know whether to take him home or to the hospital,"
the officer said.
"The hospital," it said. "Probably a good idea," he said. "Good idea," it said.
When the officer touched its elbow, it didn't kill him. Chapter 3. Mid-Pacific, 2019. It worked like this. Poseidon Projects landed a contract from a SeaWorld affiliate, actually a dummy corporation that Jack Halliburton had built out of money and imagination, to raise up a Spanish-American war-era relic, a sunken destroyer, from Samoa. But no sooner had they their equipment in place than they got an urgent summons from the U.S. Navy. There was a nuclear submarine down in the Tonga Trench, and the Navy couldn't lift it as fast as Poseidon could. There might be men still alive in it. They covered the 500 miles as fast as they could. Of course, Jack Halliburton knew that the sub had ruptured and there was no chance of survivors, but it made it possible for Russell Sutton to ply down the length of the Tonga and Kermadec trenches. He made routine soundings as he went and discovered a mysterious wreck not far from the sub. There was plenty of respectful news coverage of the two crews' efforts. Sutton's working out of professional courtesy and patriotism. Raising the Titanic had given them visibility and credibility. With all the derring-do and pathos and technological fascination of the submarine story, it was barely a footnote that Russ's team had seen something interesting on the way and had claimed salvage rights. It was an impressive sight when the sub came surging out of the depths, buoyed up by the house-sized orange balloons that Russ had brought to the task. The cameras shut down for the grisly business of removing and identifying the sailors' remains. They all came on again for the 121 flag-draped caskets on the deck of the carrier that wallowed in the sea next to the floating hulk of the sub. Then the news people went home, and the actual story began. Chapter 4. San Guillermo, California, 1931. They put a white hospital robe on it and sat it down in an examination room. It continued the safe course of imitative behavior with the doctors and nurses, and with the man and woman who were the real Jimmy's father and mother, even duplicating the mother's tears. The father and mother followed the family doctor to a room out of earshot.
"I don't know what to tell you," Dr. Farben said. "There's no evidence of any injury.